Ladies and gentlemen, program cards for this evening's performance are available at all entry points to the auditorium.
Evening, Tomas.
Good evening, Raymond. How are you?
I'm well, and yourself?
Not too bad. So
we're talking about Gershwin's Genius, title of tonight's concert, Tomas.
It's one thing to have said Gershwin's genius. It's another thing to assert that he is a genius. I think what we're looking at here tonight is it Gershwin's genius, exclamation mark? We're here to confirm it. Gershwin's genius?
Question mark.
Question mark. We're here to ask about it. And when you look at the pieces tonight, you've got 43-minute long Sibelius, but only a 30-minute long Gershwin.
I would have thought, Tomas, that perhaps Concerto for Piano and Orchestra would be a better title here, because if you can think back, for long periods there, the piano was in fact silent, and we had that gorgeous, what I call that Gershwin-esque sound of the bass clarinet, you know, that sort of haunting melody, and also we had lovely brass sounds coming in as well, in that slightly resonating sound coming in there. So I would think, with solo violin as well, I would think that it would be better titled as something, you know, I think the orchestra and the piano played equal parts there, more so than piano being accompanied by orchestra.
The title that it has is at least better than what Prokofiev was suggesting, which was 32 bars in search of an inept link, or the Drunken Concerto, both of which he mentioned when he was reviewing its first performance, its premiere in Europe. Maybe that's a little harsh?
I think so, although Prokofiev, I think, was well known for occupying, a self-proclaimed occupier of the very high moral ground of classical music in the 20th century, certainly. I've heard Prokofiev described as the Mozart of the 20th century.
By Prokofiev?
Oh, no. Not quite. But go back a bit now. We've heard that the Gershwin's maybe taking over here to us. What about the Adams piece we heard to begin with? Certainly as a contemporary composer, but one thing I do like about him is that he deals with contemporary issues. He's, as I say, he's not there out in his ivory tower or whatever. He's dealing with contemporary issues. He's getting his feet dirty, as it were. He did the opera Nixon in China. He did the Death of Klinghoffer. He did the piece after the 9/11. So certainly he's grasping contemporary issues, as I think any artist should do.
John Adams is extremely interesting. Of course, he's someone that he's right at the heart of this debate about, am I a genius? Can we really assess people's genius right now when we're still in the reflected glory of their own lives? They're actually alive. In fact, in the case of John Adams, he is alive. He's writing. He wrote a very spectacular piece, The Transmigration of the Soul, about 9/11, although he subsequently had a bit of trouble on that. But he's been accused of being anti-Semitic. He's been accused of being a bit too pro-American, a bit too rallying the flag in many cases. But on the other hand, he's also himself suggesting that he's being followed by the National Security Agency in America. In fact, he suggests to The Observer a couple of years ago that he's been blacklisted, and that when he goes through, you know, any kind of security in an airport, he's pulled aside.
But listening to you there, Tomas, isn't it? I find it slightly disappointing that almost all the Adams commentary or controversy deals with him and his political views, and he's being followed around by whoever it might be. And it seems to drown out whatever critical acclaim there is for his music. I like his music. I mean, this, we only heard a short little piece there this evening. Now, I won't call it simple, but maybe uncomplicated would be a good way of putting it. But it's gorgeous, insistent, what I call a foot-tapping rhythm, nice, pleasant melody. Sometimes you think of contemporary music as being, well, I've heard it described as sometimes squeaky gait, and that certainly wasn't the case here. I think it's just a little bit of a pity that because he has dealt with controversial contemporary issues, all the commentary then centres on those issues rather than on the music itself.
Which is exactly what I think I'm saying about the other two as well. You've got Sibelius is well known for his interest in Finnish nationalism. And at the time, that was the big controversy for him. He was a Finnish nationalist. He was essentially a political artist. And you've got Gershwin, who's dabbling in racial politics within Porky and Bess. It's some, you know, in the black community, like Duke Ellington, thought he shouldn't be involved in that. Famously, of course, he wrote Swanee. So you've got Al Jolson in blackface doing this. So he's hugely controversial in that kind of race relations aspect of his activity and his creation. Now that's kind of fading, and we're beginning to see the music beneath that. Sibelius, I think there aren't many pro-Russian, anti-Finnish nationalists out there saying that Sibelius was a bad fellow for his controversial Finnish nationalism at the beginning of the 20th century. So that's completely faded, and now we're just seeing the music, which is the residue left behind, his real gift to the immortality. And of course, John Adams, we may well see this as well as it fades too. So maybe part of the programming this evening is we're seeing that. Here's somebody who's well out of it, Sibelius, and we're going to see him now only in his musical context. Gershwin, who's half out of it, and we see that now as a piano concerto. And then the John Adams, we're still, he's just been put in there. We're still seeing him as a controversial figure who can, in 2008 he can talk about 9/11 as being an orgy of narcissism, and that he thinks that America is looking at 9/11 as a very glamorous event, he says. He calls it a very glamorous event that people keep replaying in their head in this orgy of narcissism.
Be careful what you say there. People might overhear you and misinterpret what you're saying.
this is what he's out there saying these things. He's saying these, and then he's producing this music. The music is quite different to what he's talking about, and that later on in life, we're probably not going to even see this. People like even remember 9/11 in 100 years' time. And what they're going to look at here is this very fast foxtrot. I mean, that's a fast foxtrot. I think if I was dancing that as a foxtrot, I would be. I'll probably need oxygen.
Could you imagine, Tomás, the vision that I get of it? The idea is that Chairman Mao is dancing with his wife. I mean, that old relic. Did I ever tell you I went to see him?
No.
Yeah, that's true. He's still there.
Was he talkative,
Raymond? I'm being slightly irreverent here now, but I went to see him in Beijing. You can go and visit him. And I bet you that the way they've done him up is pretty good. And he's well preserved. I'd say he looks better now than the day he died. And there's a huge queue always. But the funny thing was, Tomás, as you go to visit him, you buy flowers. Okay, so you bring them in and you place your flowers down, and there's a constantly moving queue going through, and then someone picks up the flowers and goes around and sells them to the next person in the queue. The capitalism or what?
Well, of course, they're not the only people to make some money in a capitalist fashion out of Chairman Mao. I feel that fellow Andy Warhol did a little something for that front.
A little bit of pop art there, Tomás.
Bit of pop art.
But talking about pop art, Tomás, and reverting to Gershwin, it's important to remember that in the 1920s, early 1920s, when he was really starting his career, he was a prolific songwriter. That's what he did much more than anything else, and was very talented at it and successful at it. He went to Paris, applied to study with Nadia Boulanger, but she refused to take him on because she said she was afraid her classical approach would ruin his jazz sound. So she didn't take him on. Now, as you know yourself, she took on all sorts of other people, Copland, Piazzolla from Argentina.
And of course she took on Quincy Jones. She didn't seem to have ruined his jazz.
That's true. I don't understand. But it was only after, say, for instance, Rhapsody in Blue was first performed in 1924. That's when Gershwin began a transition, I believe, from that sort of just popular musician, popular tunes, melodies and so forth, into a much more serious type of composition. He was commissioned on the basis of Rhapsody in Blue, he was commissioned to write Tonight's Concerto. It was then discovered that he knew very little about writing big music, you might say. He could write a melody, write a tune, but orchestration and all those sort of things, he hadn't done the orchestration for Rhapsody in Blue, so then he had to start learning these things. And it was a major challenge for him, which I think he rose to, and I certainly think that tonight's piece showed a progression, a move on in his ability.
Well, I think that he could have done with Sibelius. Sibelius 7.
Sibelius. Oh, you're jumping around the place now.
I am. Because, I think, isn't that what, anyone involved in love and music knows, that Sibelius 7 is the big thing.
It's a very highly regarded piece of music software, which I believe has done for musicians what Word essentially did for people like you and me, writing our articles. We now write articles in a way, we fashion them in a way which was unheard of 50 years ago. We're able to pick a clause out of one sentence, drop it into the middle of another one, italicise it, put it in bold, whatever we do, endlessly. And we're completely used to working in that fashion. It's much more recently that composers, arrangers, all sorts of musicians were able to do the same thing. I've watched, I've you know, looked over a musician's shoulder as she worked at a computer arranging music on the Sibelius. And basically up comes an empty musical score and you fill it in. So if you want the note B, you tap on B and you get bang or something like that, C, whatever it might be. And after you've done all this, then you can play it in inverted commas and you get some awful plinky plonky sort of sound, but you do get a sound for what you've just composed or arranged, and you can endlessly go back and chop and change, listen again, adjust something, just the way we can when we've got a paragraph we're not entirely happy with or we think the order of the paragraphs is wrong. You just literally flip one over the other, dead simple. You can do just the same thing here.
And you see, that's allowed other people other than Gershwin to be able to do this, because, of course, he famously hired a 55-piece orchestra to do the draft run-throughs for this concerto and was able to presumably, let's stop them there and drag this down here and move it up and let's hear it in the flutes, let's move it back to the timpani. But, yeah, it allows everyone to do that. But, again, that's what you then spend your time doing. When you're listening to Adams, or it's very like listening to Glass, and, of course, he owes a lot of debt to Glass, you're listening to and Adams, his Shaker loops, you're watching these repetitions and patterns, and you're immediately thinking, this is like a block of software where you're moving it up one, you're moving it down one, and a lot of contemporary music is very influenced by this. And I think somebody's going to write a big PhD on this, on the way in which the ability to repeat patterns and then shift them up and down in endless routines and reversals, that, never mind the serial movement, that's what allowed the kind of music that we have today.
Ladies and gentlemen, the doors will close in 5 minutes. We request that you take your seats in the auditorium. Thank you.
Nixon is all in our mind this evening.
That's
because,
right.
You know, Nixon in China is Adams's big thing. I mean, that's he. If we are looking at his genius in any way, it's the fact that he reinvented opera for the contemporary writer. I mean, I know obviously Philip Glass and many others have now pushed forward with it, but when he brings Nixon in China, when you've got that 7-7, that 747 coming onto the stage at the beginning of that opera, you know, and everyone said, well, here is a way of coming back to opera again. That's probably, you know, that's without doubt his genius element in it. And this Dances with the Chairman is an outtake, he describes it as.
Very contemporary.
Very contemporary. Of course, he was a big fan of Jimi Hendrix, or he is a big fan of Jimi Hendrix.
The director's cut.
The director's cut. So we're looking at a director's cut, an outtake from this. So we've got to think that Nixon is maybe watching from the side wings.
And do you remember
this
that?
Foxtrot?
Do you remember that visit to Moss? Was it 72?
Well, obviously, being two, I don't.
But Tomas, isn't there a subtext here that, in fact, that this opera, Nixon in China, written by Adams, is, in fact, a celebration, not so much of Nixon's visit, but that the primary purpose of it was to get Pepsi-Cola into China?
I think you're totally correct. And then on that level, I'm afraid Adams now falls below Billy Wilder, because Billy Wilder's film with James Cagney, 1, 2, 3, was about getting cola into across the Berlin Wall and into Russia, and that was a much better experience than Nixon in China.
But the population in China is much bigger.
Yeah, but they're very thirsty in Russia. Very thirsty. Of course, the Pepsi Cola wars are really only they're the proxy war to the capitalist Marxist fight.
It's a sideshow.
Which was the whole 20th century. And in fact, every one of the people tonight is also connected, Adams, Gershwin and Sibelius, by that big push between Marxism and capitalism, between the West and the East. Sibelius, he's there fighting against Russia, Mother Russia, for an independent Finland. You've got Gershwin fighting the great fight in favour of the new American culture. And you've got Adams, the late American culture. Still some optimism there. He's always talking about optimism in his work. But he's fighting against the other forces. And some people see him as a pro-capitalist, which is probably, you know, considering the criticism that he gets for a lot of his work. I think he's a lot more radical than people might think. But all of them, you've got to look at someone like Adorno. And when Adorno's looking at them, and in fact Adorno, who's a cultural critic, and he's probably the most famous cultural critic himself, and Herbert Marcuse are right up there at the top of this business. And of course, he wrote an absolute scathing piece about Sibelius. And he sent it in for publication into the New York Times, who refused it on the grounds that it was just so vicious altogether. And he basically said, you know, if Sibelius is good, then you know this throws a question mark over all music between Bach and Schoenberg, and in fact it invalidates all music between Bach and Schoenberg. And he basically really attacked the idea of comfortable music, placed in the context of something that looks alarmingly radical and individual. So that essentially you've got something like Adams, Gershwin and Sibelius. They all sound a bit modern initially, but then underneath them all there's something a little comfortable, a little foot-tapping, as you said, for Adams. There's something a little... there's dance orientated. There's a Charleston in the middle of the concerto there from Gershwin, and he wrote several dances himself. So he knows a foot-tapping tune when he sees it. And then Sibelius, the ultimate hot chocolate at the end of an evening of concert activity.
Oh, well, notwithstanding that, Thomas, I think it's a little bit more serious than hot chocolate. Maybe an Irish coffee. But notwithstanding everything you've just said, I'm certainly looking forward to the Sibelius, because it's great rousing stuff, and it has there's that gorgeous sort of signature melody in it. I won't try to impose my arrangement.
I thought you were going to whistle it.
It's whirling around in my head, but I can't get it out there. But I'm really looking forward to that, because it has that rousing stuff. I'm going to sit back now and I'm going to enjoy the Sibelius. I'm not going to try and think too much of the context in which it was written, or trying to maybe link up the three composers. I think we're going to enjoy it. I think I'm just going to go in there now and enjoy the music.
That's what they want you to do, Raymond. They want you to go in there and enjoy it and not think about it. Because there you are, you're switching off. You're not even going to consider genius or genius.
Well. Genius?
Genius. I think that's really the final kick, the final knock in the nail in the coffin here for this evening, is that we've placed Adams in the context of another an evening where it's really about comfort, switching off, toe-tap and enjoyment.
Ladies and gentlemen, all doors are now closing. We request that you take your seats in the auditorium immediately. All doors are now closing. Thank you.